My name is Roland Perry, and I'm on my 40th book at the moment. And I'm an author by trade. I author for a living. And my specialties do range through the Middle East because I wrote a book called The Australian Light Horse. And I had to do a hell of a lot of research twice in the Middle East, all over the Middle East. And for what it's worth, I'm the only author, has done the complete story of World War One and what happened in the Middle East. Others have either charged up the left side on the Mediterranean side with Allenby and the Light Horse, that's the cavalry, or they've charged up through all the forts, the Hejaz Railway, with Lawrence. And I'm the only one, for what it's worth, who's done the complete story. So I have a good grip on the history of how things happened in 1917 and 18, and they are now incredibly critical and relevant.
No, I think you're absolutely right. But just a couple of weeks ago, we did an investigation into the death of T.E. Lawrence, and
Yes.
that was fascinating in itself. So, can you just say something about the First World War and his involvement and other things that you've picked up in the book? Because it was crucial, in destroying the Ottoman control of that part of the world.
That's absolutely right. And don't forget, they had, I'm sure you haven't forgotten, but I just say that they'd lost their empire in Europe and now they were desperate. I mean, absolutely drop dead desperate to hang on to the Middle East. Allenby was pushed out of the European war because he didn't get on with some of the hierarchy there. And he had to run the Desert Mounted Column and the soldiers in the Middle East to try and defeat the Turks. It was the British versus the Turks, and stop them. It was stalemate at Gaza. They couldn't get through Gaza. The British tried twice. That's the military, the army. But remember, the army can only march 7 or 8 kilometers or miles. I guess it's kilometers actually, but anyway, let's say 3, 5 miles in the desert. It's pretty well impossible. It gets up to 50 degrees. So the main force, the strike force, was the cavalry, which was, I'm using the term loosely because Australian soldiers on horses were not cavalry until late in the war, but they were the dominant force. Of all the force, 75% were Anzac, 15% British cavalry. There was a Jewish contingent, a West Indian contingent, can you believe? And they made up to 100%. Now, what happened was Allenby decided to, there was only one way to take Gaza. This is in October. It's very relevant right now, actually. The 31st, it's now, of course, the 2nd of November. But on the 31st, he hatched a plan, or he was behind a plan with the Australian general, Harry Chevelle, who ran the horses, who ran the light horse, the cavalry. And the deal was this: if they didn't break through Gaza, there'd be stalemate in World War One, exactly what they did not want, because it would have meant trench warfare from then on, and the Turks would have ended up controlling the Middle East at the end of the war, at the Paris Convention in 1919. So it was absolutely critical they break through. And the plan was the light horse would attack Beersheba in the south of Gaza, and divert the Turkish forces. They didn't think we'd defeat them. That's the Anzac force. In fact, it was just Australians in this case. 800 horsemen attacked Beersheba, which was heavily fortified with machine guns and what have you. Snipers, rifles, 3,500 soldiers were defending it, Turkish soldiers. And they had to send reinforcements down, and this took them away from Gaza and allowed the Brits to come in, the British military, the army, to come in and take Gaza, which was a huge, a massive breakthrough for history, in fact, not just for in that war, because it meant the Turks were on the run from Gaza. After that, they didn't think anyone could break through. But because the Light Horse had an amazing victory, it was one of the great charges of all time, and they took the town. They lost about, I think, 70 men. Was it 70 men? They lost 70 horses, I know that, of the 800, but they managed to charge through. And this meant the Turks were on the run. Now, The Australian Light Horse and the New Zealand, this is the Anzac Force, were dominant in tackling the two Turkish armies in Armageddon in the north of Gaza and next to the Mediterranean, heading towards Damascus. Now, Lawrence of Arabia, that everyone knows about, he did a great job as a terrorist, effectively attacking the Turkish forts on the Hejaz Railway. I've been up to every one of those forts up the railway. And he held one army there while the Light Horse attacked those two armies and basically destroyed them over the next year and up until October 1918. And Lawrence, and then the Light Horse under Harry Javel, swept across and helped Lawrence properly defeat that Third Army. So they were dominant. And then you may remember that Lawrence was sent back to England because he disagreed with the carve-up of the Middle East. He thought it would go to the Saudis, and it didn't. And he left and went back to England. And then, after he'd gone, not dependent on him going, but after he'd been sent back to England, the Light Horse under Harry Javel, with the Arabs in the back, you know, being used when needed, not terribly important, but they were used, to then sweep up and push the Turks right through Syria and out over the line, over the boundary line, into Turkey. And they've been there for the last 106 years. So I'm leading up to what I have to say about Erdogan. Erdogan has popped his head up over the parapet. He wants, and remember, this is only 106 years. This is not a long time since the Turks controlled the whole region, or were fighting to control it in 1918. And they want it back. And Erdogan wants it back. And that's why he's now siding with Hamas and Hezbollah and the Syrians and the Iranians to crush Israel. That's his main aim, so that they can get back in. If Israel goes and collapse, then the Americans have no proxy in the region. The Russians would be on the side of the Turks, and the Chinese would be on the side of the Turks. They have a population of 85 million, and they have a pretty big army.
Roland, it's almost as if you're saying that Syria doesn't exist, or it's a spent force, so they would have something to say. And they are having something to say as Erdogan tries to push south, aren't they?
Yeah, they have. But just imagine Israel goes. I don't think it will. I think they'll fight. I think they will not give up the territory. But if they did and they were obliterated and kicked out, Syria would have no chance against the Turks. There's no chance that they would be able to defeat the Turks. So that's what Erdogan is thinking. Remember, Erdogan is 69 years old. So he would have been born around the 50s. His parents and his grandparents would, and everyone he knows and all historians, everyone he's ever met, would be smarting over the fact that they'd lost the Middle East. Now, that's not 500 years. They controlled it for 400. They want it back. And that's in the mind of most of the Turkish hierarchy. Over time, the big barrier, of course, is Israel. Once you've got Israel fighting and with nuclear weapons, and the Americans using them as a proxy in that region, and the Brits also, they're not going to have a chance. So that's why he's now pushing very hard for the destruction of Israel. That's Erdogan.
Yeah, but what about the Russians? Listen, they have a base in Syria, naval base, which they're not, and they don't really want the Turks, a NATO country, taking that over, do they?
No, they don't. But they are particularly weak at the moment. They're not a big player for obvious reasons, because of their war. And they are vulnerable at the moment, but they hate the idea of any ascendancy from the US. So they're going to be coming in on the side of the Turks if anything happens.
Well, you may well be right. I mean, you know, it's always been a volatile region throughout history. And I think, you know, we have to just look at, it's quite right, you know, to look at Israel as a, if there was a major conflagration down there, it might end up with the boundary being drawn that didn't include, you know, the current rulers of Israel at all. It may be other people. But anyway, back to Lawrence, because He was very much fighting with the Arabs. He didn't agree with the idea. In fact, actually, it was a kind of betrayal of the things that he'd agreed with the Arabs, as the Brits then decided that they were going to use the Arabs to get the Ottomans out, but then they were going to hand a lot of the land the Arabs wanted over to the new Israeli state.
That's correct, and that's what happened, of course, with the old Palestine. And excuse me, and it's fraught from that time on, because once the state of Israel developed in 48, or was built in 48, then the troubles began, of course, because they were inserted into the region. They say for historical reasons, others don't say it, but they are very fixed on that, and they're not going to give up while they've got a powerful leader they've got at the moment. I'm not agreeing with it. I'm just saying that is the situation. They're going to fight. So I think this conflagration will continue for 10 years. That's my
Well,
prediction, right?
maybe. I mean, there's been leaks, Roland. I don't know if you've seen them, by the Iranians, allegedly, that the Israelis simply plan to push all of the inhabitants that are left after the place has been flattened,
Yes.
into Sinai.
Well, I didn't know that. No one knows what the Israelis are really planning, what the deep plan is. I think they must have an attitude of absolutely destroying Hamas and Hezbollah. That's the thing that the military will want to do, and I mean wiping them out. If you know anything about it, and I do, I've been in the region and I know what Hamas is like, and Hamas is a brutal regime. There's been nothing like it in a couple of hundred years. And they will stop at nothing, and they're de determined. And so
Well,
it's
hang
not
on. A
sketchy.
lot of the listen, Roland. A lot of the even Jordanians and particularly Palestinians will
Yeah.
say that Israel has been a brutal regime.
Well, of course they will. They're opposed to them. And they've been using that propaganda, as the Israelis have against the others, for a long time, since they were formed in 48. But that doesn't stop the reality of it. Forget who's propagandizing. What has happened? You've got one state that wants, that is, has the right to be there by the United Nations, as it was back then, 48. And there's a connection for the Russians. They were one of the first to put the hand up to support Israel. They're not doing it now. Australia does. Australia, because they were there, as I've said to you, fighting the Turks. They fought the Turks. And they sided with the incoming Jews, the Jews that were coming back in to form the state. They really created, Australia created the conditions, the Australian force created the conditions for the Israeli state to be built. That's what happened, of course, after World War II. So there is a connection with the Australians. I just happen to know that they voted for Israel and the Russians were first up. And my theory on that, you may well know, is that Victor Rothschild had a big say. He set up the intelligence services for Israel because he was in MI5 and then later worked for MI6, a big player. And of course, my dissertation without question now is that he actually was passing information to the Russians too. So I had three connections in intelligence. He had the intelligence himself to do that, but he tripped up here and there, as we saw in the mid-80s.
Now, look, I must ask you, because you know you wrote The Fifth Man just a few years after. Well, two interesting things happened. One was Victor Rothschild died. The other was that we had the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so, what evidence have you got? And have the Russians even admitted that he really was the fifth man? Obviously, he was a very highly placed individual in Britain during World War II, during the
Yes.
Cold War, during the Thatcher era, during the Wilson era. He was very close to the cabinet and to the it had the ear of the prime minister. I mean, it was almost unthinkable that this guy would be working for the Russians or for the Soviets as they were then.
Well, that's a natural, isn't it? I mean, everyone who doesn't know anything, I remember being at a dinner party in London, oh, 4 or 5 years ago, and one guy was having a crack at me. For writing The Fifth Man, he knew nothing. He was a banker. He just thought, oh, Rothschild was a banker. Yes, he stepped into that as well at some point after his, as in the family tradition. But Rothschild was a master spy, and I have direct evidence from Ivan the Terrible, he was called, Serov, S-E-R-O-V, who was Stalin's henchman. He was his hatchet man. He was his killer. All through that period in the 40s and 50s, until Stalin was dead, and then Ivan got into a bit of trouble because he was obviously, being a brute, he'd made a lot of enemies on the way through within Russia as well as outside. Now, Ivan kept diaries. He stuck them in a dacha, in his dacha in Moscow, when he thought he might be in trouble with the authorities, because he was on the nose after having brutal power under Stalin. And those diaries were ended up in the hands of his granddaughter, who inherited the dacha. And she pulled down the garage where they were and found that them cemented into the wall in a suitcase, the diaries. Now, the diaries were released to a very obscure Russian archive. MI6 got hold of them, and I therefore had access to a point to them as well. They were made public at one point as well. And it's very clear, Serov hates Rothschild because he's a Jew, but he admits that he was very useful in along with the other members of the major ring, Philby and company. He admits it clearly in his diaries that Rothschild was involved. And Rothschild was passing, where he was rather cute, Victor, was that he did meet Russians, key Russians, in the embassy at parties. Because he was a Labour lord with a left-wing bias, obviously, and a communist bias underneath. But he never did what Blunt and Burgess and company did and met controls, that's Russian controls, in parks or alleys or anything like that. That never happened with Victor. It was just too much for him. And what he did was he passed it to Blunt, and he passed it to Burgess, and he passed it to Philby. I have evidence, direct evidence of all that. And that's partly in the fifth man. I've added a bit more, and I'm going to update the book at some point soon. There's no question about him spying for the Russians. When Ivan, doesn't like him, because it's not so much that he was a Jew, but he was arrogant when he met him. Ivan felt belittled. You can read between the lines, because you can imagine Lord Rothschild, one of the great establishment figures in Britain, at a Russian embassy. This is where he met him, at a party, where there are a lot of other Brits there as well. I don't know if there are conservatives there, but there certainly would have, a lot of Labour Party would have been invited. And they didn't get on terribly well, because Rothschild wasn't going to be bullied by a little peasant thug like Ivan, the Terrible Serov. So they didn't get on, but he realised, Serov admitted that he'd been very, very
valuable. Okay, well, look, I mean, what about the Russian authorities themselves? Have they ever actually officially admitted that Victor Rothschild was a spy?
No. The same as MI6 and MI5, haven't the British government have never. It got close, as you may remember, when Thatcher was asked whether he was the fifth man, and she gave a very tepid response, which brought a lot of fearsome attitude against her, because she hadn't really said he wasn't a spy. She just said, we have no evidence, or or I'm advised by MI5, something along those lines. The governments have never, see, Cairncross was put up as the fifth, and this is absolute rubbish, and I've done serious homework on this with the Russians themselves. I was one of the few bunnies that went across after the walls went down. You would be amazed at the number of people that turned down the opportunity on their own. I went over, got a journalistic contact, did not go through the KGB. I did talk to the old KGB, but I went through journalists who got me the interviews. And what happened was, and you'll remember, there was a plethora of books in the 90s. None of them gave you anything of any guts. And this is because academics, God bless them, but they're not very street smart. Academics were being lined up with KGB people to write books. And this is the crunch of it. The information was given to them from the files in the KGB, by the KGB. That's at Donetsky Square in Moscow. No one actually got in and looked at the files. So all this rubbish that went on, and great books and volumes, Can you remember any book that actually exposed any more than
Well, no, I think you're
no.
right. But
I'm
look,
I've got
hang
to
on.
say, just
At the end
I've got
of
to
the day,
continue.
Roland, it's really about what evidence you managed to drag out about what specific secrets that Victor handed to the Soviets at what time, and so roughly from what period? Because this is an amazingly long time, right the way through
Yes,
World War, right the
well,
way through World War II and the Cold War. You know, this is many decades he's supposed to have been spying. So what kind of things was he handing over, and have you got evidence of?
Oh, well, look, I've got direct evidence because his major effort, and it was still, you wouldn't say it was traitorous because we were officially on the side of the Russians during the war. When I say we, you, the Brits. Now, what he did was he was very, very cute, very, very smart. I mean, he had an IQ allegedly of 184, which is off the charts. You've still got to be able to get on with people and have EQ. But anyway, we'll give him that. What he did was, because he had a science background and he had a mighty mind, he became the what was the word? Investigator of all research facilities in the UK during the war. So he could go in on the basis that he was going to make sure that all research facilities had tightened security so that the Germans couldn't get in, right? Or couldn't get anything. So he went round everywhere. He went, and the one that I latched onto because of the Australian connection was Mark Oliphant, Dr. Marcus Oliphant, Sir Mark Oliphant, as it turned out later. But anyway, he developed radar. He was the key behind radar, and he was one of, I think, the major urger and pusher. Well, I know he was the major urger and pusher for the atomic bomb. And when it wasn't even understood, I'll tell you how lack of understanding was. Rothschild went to see Oliphant, and Oliphant had working for him Fuchs, Klaus Fuchs, right, who was a spy for the Russians. He's an East German Jew who went over, was employed, and when I interviewed Oliphant, this is where I've got the inside running on this. Oliphant was an Australian. I mean, he did tremendous work in Birmingham University, really great work, and he developed radar. But he had working with him Fuchs and Perls, another East German Jew, and Fuchs, the government, and this is Oliphant laughing on the phone, or that's putting it too far. You could tell that he thought it was amusing. It was droll that the government said, "No, Fuchs cannot work with you in radar, but put him in the other lab that you've got, which is uranium-235, developing the bomb." They didn't know it was called a bomb at that stage, but he said, "No, that work's not as important. Don't let him work on radar." So Fuchs was pushed into the most vital area of all, and that was the second laboratory that Oliphant had. Now, he knew this Oliphant later. I mean, we laughed, not laughed about it, we talked about it. But during the war, Rothschild went to his laboratory, that's Oliphant's laboratory, and as Oliphant said to me, he absorbed everything like a blotter. He took notes. He did everything right. So he looked at both laboratories, was particularly interested in the radar at that point. This was 1941. The bomb thing hadn't developed till later in the year through the Maud Committee and all that stuff, which you, I'm sure, know about. So what happens is Rothschild's there and he slips a magnetron. It's the side of a saucer. Cup and saucer, the size of a saucer, into his pocket, leaves the facility, goes to Blunt, gives it to Blunt. They do all the drawings and photographs of it, and then that is it, not the magnetron itself. That is taken to the Russian embassy, and a guy called Barkovsky, who was very key in the Russian embassy, he might have been the principal KGB man, and he sends it off in the diplomatic bag, all the information they've got. And then Rothschild sends the magnetron back to Oliphant. How much chutzpah and cheek is this? And says, "Tighten up your security, yours, enjoyed meeting you, yours, Rothschild, right? Now, how do I know the full circle? Because I went to Moscow after the walls went down with all the interviews I had, two large trips over 6 weeks each, and I interviewed Barkovsky. He said, oh, yes, Blunt gave us the magnetron information. So I had the full circle, and that's just one example of Rothschild spying, just one, and that's the connection. So I had him on tape, on camera. This is Barkovsky admitting about that they got the information from Blunt, but it had been passed to Blunt by Rothschild. Does that make sense for you?
Well, it's pretty good evidence. You know, obviously, that's exactly the sort of thing.
I love that. I love your response, because when I brought the book out, I felt the pressure of having named Rothschild. Obviously, don't forget, I'm an interloper Oz. You know, what the hell are you doing writing about the British establishment? How dare you? The fact that I did 3 years research on all this and wrote accordingly, and the fact that the William Armstrong, the biggest publisher in England at the time, commissioned me on it. Well, I went to him, and he made the remark. He said, you've pulled the whole story together for me, which was one of the biggest pats on the back I've ever had in 50 years, because he was a great fellow, William. He's now long gone. The father of Dido, the singer. That's what his claim to fame would be now, William Armstrong, but a fantastic publisher. He was doing all the major books in the 80s, and he took me on with it. But I gave a 20,000-word evidential statement to him, and that's why he then said, go ahead with the book.
So, I mean, it is, I mean, it's a fascinating tale, but look, let's focus down on the results of all of this shenanigans and the creation of the Israeli state, because right now we've got nearly just over 2 million people in Gaza who are being, I mean, I think the only way to describe it is a form of collective punishment. In amongst them, there are some Hamas fighters, we're getting these kind of Big Brother style announcements, move to the south of Gaza. And then the south of Gaza is being bombed by the Israelis. So it's a pretty horrific, I mean, we're also seeing, I mean, over here in the UK, astoundingly, even Keir Starmer, the leader of the opposition, is refusing to call for a ceasefire. He's saying that this is all okay. And he's supposed to be a human rights lawyer. Most of the commentators around the world are pointing out that this collective punishment is a war crime. So anyway, what do you make of what's going on now? Where's it heading, do you think?
Well, I've sort of tried to outline that it's going to go on for 10 years. And six Australian prime ministers, the only one that didn't stand up, six together made a joint statement backing Israel. So, I mean, you know, you've got a lot of weight there that you might not know their names and stuff, but it's like your last six prime ministers getting up and saying, support Israel. So, and none of them are Jews, by the way, none of the prime ministers. So there's a real support for Israel. Now, you're asking what they're doing about Hamas. Well, look what happened last week when one of their commanders was hiding under a refugee camp, wasn't he? Wasn't a refugee place? And they blew it up. Right? The Israelis blew it up.
I'm not sure what to believe. You know, we were told, weren't we, that Hamas misfired a rocket and blew up a hospital. Well, you know, people...
No, that's not what I'm talking about. There's another...
This is what I'm pointing out, is that there is a tremendous amount of lies going around.
Well, you're calling that a lie. I don't know. I'm not there. If I was there now... with a hard hat on, and I don't want to be there, to be frank, I would be trying to find out whether that was true or not. And you can, if you're really sharp, and some of those journalists are terrific over there. I mean, it's very brave stuff. It's fine for me to go over and interview spies long after events, but they're right in the middle of it. If they could probably tell you a bit more on the ground, some of them are just ciphers.
Well, look, one of the main characters in all of this, both in Australia and here, is a certain Rupert Murdoch. And it was announced, I think it was about 7 or 8 years ago, that he has been given some rather nice oil concessions, a company called Genie Oil, in the Golan Heights, which is disputed territory between Israel and the Syrians. So, I mean, you know, he has got skin in the fight here, hasn't he, with financial...
I wouldn't think he'd worry too much. He's got out now, hasn't he? And I don't think he'd be I don't, that'd be very, it may well be true, and it may, but it's very small fry in his operations. I don't
Is
think
it?
that'd be a
Well,
major
okay.
issue.
So, what do you make? What do you make of this propaganda battle, anyway?
Oh, well, look, I think the bottom line is that the Israelis are fighting for their existence because of the reasons I've outlined. There's no question that Hamas and Hezbollah and the Iranians would love to crush Israel. Okay, so you might agree with that, and others do agree with that, right? That's I'm not taking a stand on that. That's the situation. Now, what do you do if France and Germany and everyone has decided to crush England? Okay, you'd manage to get out of that in World War II, but this is much tighter. It's a much smaller space, and it's going to be very hard. So they're going to have to defend themselves or perish. Now, what do? They say, right, we've got to crush the people that are crushing us. They try and seek out the Hamas leaders, the commanders. You didn't mention, the initial evolution of this in recent weeks, and that is Hamas going in and slaughtering people. So what do the Israelis do? Do you think they slaughter their own to make a point? No. That is absolute bollocks. And if you believe that, you're off the planet. So that happened. What do the Israelis do? They sit there saying, oh, well, we are virtually confining the Palestinians there. But what do we do? Let them be supported by Hamas and Hezbollah and come in and crush us? Or do we fight back? It's simple. It's basic. It's Jurassic Park, isn't it? This is survival of the strongest and the fittest.
Well,
And Israel
what
will be
about
fighting.
some commentators have said it's just a convoluted land grab, basically, like the Israelis have been grabbing land ever since 1948.
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert on that, but that would be one strong accusation. Didn't they give land back recently? I thought they did.
I'm not sure about that. There has
I'm
been a
looking at it very coldly. I know the history of how it was created,
yeah.
Israel. I realize how tough they are, and they have committed atrocities with the Palestinians, no question about it. And that is in response to atrocities against them often. I mean, the 67 war and all the rest of it, that wasn't Israel attacking anyone. You've got to go, the history, but you could say, well, why are they there? Because they believe in the Old Testament and Israel is a town, is the place to go. I mean, you've got to remember that West Australia was cited as a possible place for the Jews to go after the destruction in World War II. The attempt of genocide in world, it was just about 6 million dead. Australia was cited as a place, Western Australia was. So I've sort of followed it from that position as well. And then they ended up in the Middle East.
Was Victor religious?
Oh, no, not at all. He's an atheist.
Well, because it's interesting, isn't it, that he played such an important role in this so-called biblical thing, but he didn't actually believe the Bible.
No, but he did. He didn't think it was biblical. He saw what happened to the Jews. Don't forget the Rothschilds in every country were made examples of, and he was a prime mover in getting back at Hitler. I mean, they would have strung him up for sure if they'd caught him. So he was defending the Jews all around the world. It wasn't necessarily. He was pushing for Israel, but of course he was instrumental, as I said, in the intelligence center. Once the decision was made to set up a state, he was called upon by important Jews that were behind it to set up the intelligence
Anyway,
services
look,
because
we've only got a minute left, Roland. What's
yeah.
your latest book?
I'm doing a book on MacArthur and Blamey. It's not out until next year. Douglas MacArthur in the Pacific War and Blamey, the Australian general, and they clashed. I'm going to call it, well, the nominal title is The Battle of the Generals. I've just submitted it to the publisher, and it will be very revealing about MacArthur, much more than any one of the biographers have ever done. I haven't got near it.
And if any listeners are interested in following your work, have you got a website, social media, anything like that?
Yeah, I've got a website. It's just RolandPerry.com will pick it up, and you can see some of my stuff. I don't work hard on the I'm too busy on the books,
Well, that's good.
Tony.
Well done. Anyway, look, Roland Perry, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed that, Tony. I really did.